Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. Well, I am very glad to be back in the studio with you. It feels as though I've been gone forever, although I haven't. But we have a great show lined up for you today. It's over 100 years ago since Upton Sinclair's novel The Jungle caused an uproar by shining a light on the meatpacking industry and its workers. Well, have things today really changed? And how does the meat industry impact our culture, our society as a whole? Professor Donald Stull joins me in just a moment to discuss this huge topic from his perspective as an anthropologist. And we'll learn more about the controversial bill recently passed by the Iowa legislature that protects factory farms from undercover investigations. I believe that law is commonly known as the ag gag. In the second half of today's show, I'm joined by Roy Sessions, a highly acclaimed medical doctor who spent 30 years treating cancer patients. Today, he'll share his philosophies on the doctor, the patient, and the journey. Some important information coming up from both of my guests today. So let me introduce Donald Stull. He has a PhD, MPH. He is an applied cultural anthropologist who's conducted basic and applied research throughout the United States. He's professor and past chair of anthropology at the University of Kansas and was editor-in-chief of Human Organization, the leading international journal of applied social science. He also served as president of the Society of Applied Anthropology from 2005 to 2007. Professor Stull is co-author of the highly praised Slaughterhouse Blues, The Meat and Poultry Industry in North America, and he also co-edited the landmark book Any Way You Cut It, Meat Processing and Small Town America. Professor Donald Stull, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
Pleased to have you here, and this is, I think, an important piece of work. But I want to just go back a little bit, a few years, almost 30 years, I guess, 25 plus years. And you've studied the meat and poultry industry for that long. What does it mean to be an anthropologist and study it from your perspective?
Well, I began studying the industry in the mid-1980s. The Ford Foundation was preparing for the 1990 census, which was going to reveal that the American population was increasingly that more and more immigrants were coming to the United States, and so they were interested in seeing how established residents and newcomers were accommodating with one another. And so I led a team of researchers that studied Garden City, Kansas, which was the only rural site. The others were Chicago, Miami, Philadelphia, Monterey Park, and Houston. And so the Garden City was fast shifting from overwhelmingly white Anglos to a multicultural community with large numbers of Vietnamese and Latin American immigrants. And what brought those immigrants to Garden City, which is in the southwest corner of Kansas, was the beef industry. And Garden City was home to, at that time, the world's largest beef plant. So I began by studying the workforce, which were largely coming from Vietnam and Mexico and elsewhere in Latin America. And that led me and my co-author, Michael Broadway, a geographer at Northern Michigan University, to become increasingly interested in the meat industry. And so we have followed that industry now for 25 years, working not only with beef in Kansas, but also in Oklahoma and Nebraska, with pork processing in Oklahoma and poultry processing in my hometown, which mm-hmm. is where I am now, which is a small town in western Kentucky.
Now, I understand, you know, a lot of people who do this kind of work and report on this kind of work are vegetarian, I'm assuming because of much of what they see. But I read that you and Michael Broadway, who co-wrote this with you, actually met over a big burger.
Well, We did. It's ironic, but we met in Wichita in a hot afternoon and shared juicy cheeseburgers, and thus began our odyssey with the meat industry over a long time. We continue to be meat eaters, both of us. I think we're probably more what Michael Pollan and others call conscientious omnivores. We, as an anthropologist, I'll eat anything that's put in front of me and be thankful for it.
Right.
But we have also become much more knowledgeable about where our food comes from, and that has certainly affected our eating patterns.
Mm. What was it that drove? What was it that really interested you in this kind of work, though? Because you've been doing it for a long time, and I know in the book you said you've tried to really present a very balanced report, but of course you do come to your own conclusions after 25 plus years of research. But what kept you going in this line of work?
Well, it's a fascinating industry, and food, of course, is the largest industry in the world, and about 35% or so of the grains grown in the world are go into meat, and livestock and meat production supports about 1 billion people. So it's out of a total of 7 billion in the world. So it's an important part of our world, and it is fascinating to us. There are issues regarding work, regarding immigration, regarding environmental mm-hmm. Issues, of course, things like animal welfare and animal rights. So the meat industry really transcends many areas of our lives, and we have continued to find something new and challenging for all that time.
Right.
We tried to get out of the business a couple of times, but we continue to be pulled back into it.
Right.
And I guess we probably will for years to come.
Well, I've done shows before on CAFO, which is a concentrated animal feeding operations. We've discussed that quite in depth. And I want to go into some of the human cost, as you talk about in the book. We're going to take a very quick break, and when we come back, I have a lot of questions for you. We're joined by Professor Donald Stull in this segment. His book was described by Eric Schlosser, who's the author of Fast Food, another great book, as being one of the best books on today's meatpacking industry. It's called Slaughterhouse Blues, The Meat and Poultry Industry in North America. Please stay with us. We'll be right back.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in, providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair discusses issues that are important to you, like good health and well-being, finding a new job and building your business, overcoming life's big challenges and making sense out of chaos, and living with passion and joy. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific for Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for show schedule and guest information.
Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772. Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Listen to podcasts of past shows at conversationslive.net.
There's nothing else like it on the dial. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, and my guest in this segment is Professor Donald Stull. He is the author, with Michael Broadway, of Slaughterhouse Blues, the Meat and Poultry Industry in North America. And this has been described as one of the most impactful books. It contains so much information in here about what's gone on in the past and what's going on now. It's a very valuable piece of work. And I wanted to talk in this segment, Donald, if we can, about the human cost. You go into quite a great deal of detail about this in the book. You mentioned that it's mostly immigrants who are coming in and working in this industry, assuming because it's something we don't want to do. I don't know. Assuming because it's low pay. Talk to me a little bit about that, if you would.
Well, the meat and poultry industry has always relied heavily on immigrant workers, going back to the days of the jungle and Upton Sinclair. And the reason is that you don't have to speak English to work in a meat or poultry plant. You don't have to have any pre-existing job skills. You learn your skills on the job, and the work is hard. It is dangerous. It is relatively low paying. For example, the average wage for meat and poultry workers in the United States today is about $11.25, which, if you per hour, if you annualize that, that would place all of the meatpacking workers at or near the federal poverty line, and all meatpacking workers' children would be eligible for free lunches. So it's a in rural communities, $11.25 is seen as pretty good pay, but it really is a low wage job, and the work is quite dangerous. It's quite distasteful. You're working in either very hot conditions or very cold conditions. And the management of meatpacking, about 90% of meatpacking workers are production workers or hourly workers. Only about 10% are management. And they tend to be white males. Office staff tends to be white females. And then production workers are, it depends on the plant, but 75-80% people of color. And of those, probably 75 or 80% are immigrants or refugees. And they find these jobs as a way to earn a wage that they can support themselves on, although not very well.
Mm-hmm.
And it allows them to get a foothold in America, and then in some cases work their way up.
Right, right. So Upton Sinclair's book, for those who aren't familiar with it, The Jungle, I think it was written around 1904. But he, you know, I read this ages ago when I was vegetarian myself. I'm no longer vegetarian, but when I was vegetarian, I read this book. And it did discuss the atrocities that meat people working at these plants faced. You, in the book, talk about you went on a tour. You went on several tours over a period of time and were lectured to by somebody as you came back. And I found that really interesting. And give us some perspective, if you would, of how things have changed since Sinclair's The Jungle and what you actually found when you went on these tours yourself.
Well, yes, I went on a number of tours, and I also did research in a plant for about 7 months in a beef plant. Industry has become much more mechanized. It's become, in many cases, roboticized. So poultry, which is, of course, the smallest of the farmed animals that we eat, is highly roboticized, highly mechanized, because the animals are uniform, more or less, and they're also small. Pork is also is mechanized to a large degree. Beef production, on the other hand, while it is much more mechanized than it was in Sinclair's day, still requires, each beef cow is different in many ways, different size and so forth. And so it still requires a great deal of manual labor, and the knife, the meat hook, and the steel, the sharpening steel, still remain the basic tools of the trade. So if Upton Sinclair were to walk into a modern-day beef plant, he would be certainly impressed with a lot of new machinery, but he would also recognize the kind of he would be quite at home in a modern beef plant. He would still see workers working at a very fast pace. About 400 head of cattle an hour is what the normal speed is for large plants. He would still see many immigrants, mostly immigrants, although they would be Mexicans and Somalis and Ethiopians and Guatemalans rather than Poles and Slovaks and Lithuanians, which is what the workers of his day. So it hasn't really changed that much. Certainly, Upton Sinclair's book, The Jungle, was responsible for the passage of the Pure Food and Drug Act and the Meat Inspection Act, both signed on the same day in 1906 by President Teddy Roosevelt. He was primarily concerned with the plight of workers. He was not particularly, he didn't write the book because of his concern about meat safety. He wrote it about his concern about worker safety. He would still be, he would be very disappointed, I think, in how little progress has been made in that area.
Yeah, from your description in the book, I mean, this whole operation sounded very militaristic.
They are. They're highly, it's a factory. The meat and poultry production is a factory. They refer to it as a disassembly. A live animal enters the plant and it exits as meat, sometimes processed to the point where it's ready to be cooked and eaten by the consumer. Mm. So it's a highly regimented. Workers are highly scheduled. They are, you know who what the worker's job is by the color of the hard hat that she or he wears. And so it's workers are work an eight-hour shift. They get a 15-minute break about 2.5 hours into their shift, a 30-minute break about halfway through their shift for lunch, and that's it. The rest of the time, they are standing at a station doing a single task, hundreds or thousands of times an hour. So meatpacking was the first industry to de-skill, which means that each worker may perform highly skilled tasks, but he learns it on the job, and each worker does one particular thing.
Yeah.
And when you can do that, you can then mechanically regulate the speed at which the workers perform, and then you can further control them.
Pretty high pressure, I would think. I found this interesting. You said in the book that in Old English, in the King James Bible, for example, they referred to dark meat as meat, and white meat meant cheese and milk.
Yes, we, that didn't mean then what it means now, that's true.
Yeah, and I heard you talking about how, you know, we all know after swine flu that the pork people went on a big campaign and advertised it as the other white meat. Was that successful for them, that campaign?
That campaign has been highly successful. So over the last 30 or 40 years, we've seen a beef consumption peaked in the mid-1970s and has been coming down. Poultry consumption has, of course, been going up for about the same amount of time. Pork consumption has remained roughly stable, and I think that's largely because the pork industry has been able to divert any kinds of concerns based upon the fact that it's red meat. Mm. And so it's sort of traveled under the radar screen, and that campaign has been highly successful.
Interesting. And you also said that we eat about 100 pounds more of meat today than we did 100 years ago.
Yes, we do. And that has been, 100 years ago, we ate very little chicken, and chicken was very expensive. It would have been one of the most expensive, if not the most expensive, items on a restaurant menu. And that has changed now, of course, and it's one of the least expensive. So we ate about, altogether, beef, pork, and chicken, and other flesh, we ate about 124 pounds per capita in 1910. We eat about 100 and almost 200 pounds of flesh protein per capita today. And we eat and the big growth has come in poultry, also in fish as well, which most of the fish we eat is also farmed. And that relates really to how cheap it is to produce it, how quick the animals can go from maturity to they go from birth to death for chickens in 10 weeks.
Yeah,
and
that's
we can
shocking.
Turn out a whole lot more of them than we can for beef cattle.
Now, when I've talked about this before, when we've talked about those concentrated animal feeding organizations at these factory farms, sometimes I've talked with environmental scientists and they've said, you know, we need to eat less meat. You say us becoming vegetarian is not necessarily a panacea for world population because that puts strains on grains. It puts strains in whole other areas. Talk to us a little about that, if you would.
Well, it does. I mean, there about one third of the grains that we produce worldwide now go into animals, and there's no and what is happening is that not only do Americans eat more meat than we did a century ago, but the rest of the world does as well. And so there is a dramatic increase in meat consumption in the developing nations. And so the United Nations predicts that by 2050 we'll have about a little over 9 billion people in the world, which is up from 7 billion today. So it's a not quite a one-third increase. But they project that we will need to double our meat production to meet demand in that same period. So the demand for meat is growing dramatically.
Right.
Now, people say we should eat less meat or do away with it altogether. The problem with that is, and there have been studies, the World Wildlife Fund conducted a study of the United Kingdom, which concluded that if the United Kingdom was to abandon beef and dairy in its diet and go to analogs such as tofu, that would, in fact, put greater demands on arable land. You'd need to put a lot more land in crop production. That would in turn lead to things like deforestation. So there is no going from meat eating to a vegetarian diet. It's not going to solve the problems of world food production.
Right. Well, we're going to take a very quick break. When we come back, I want to ask you something that shocked me, and I want you to tell me it's not true, but I know it is. So stay tuned. We're talking with Professor Donald Stull, and his book is called Slaughterhouse Blues, written with Michael Broadway. We're coming right back.
OMG! Grammar abuses, no, LOL. Hire a copywriter today and make sure your business communications rise above the crowd and deliver the results you need. Call 800-495-7617 today. BTW, IMHO, copywriters rule. Call 800-495-7617. BFN.
If you love dogs, tune in to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes live every Wednesday from 2 to 3 p.m. We'll talk about everything dog and interview authors, experts, and amazing organizations, both locally and nationally. And don't even get me started on the pet food industry. I'm Julie Forbes. Find us online at www.dogradioshow.com and also as a free podcast on iTunes. The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, an evolved perspective on life with dogs.
Next week on Conversations Live, where Vicki St. Clair, world champion adventure racer Robin Benicasa, talks about the power of synergy. Whether you're building a successful lifelong marriage, wanting your kids to clean up their room, working on a short-term project with colleagues, or planning to scale a mountain, Benicasa coaches you over the finish line to success. Join us next week at noon for How Winning Works. See conversationslive.net for podcasts of past shows and what's next.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
Don't forget, this is Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. My guest in this segment is Professor Donald Stull. He is an applied cultural anthropologist and has spent his career looking at the meat industry and poultry industry in North America. His book is called Slaughterhouse Blues, and that's what we're talking about right now. And in there, Professor Stull, well, I heard this actually in an interview that I heard you do. But you talked about something, and I thought, oh, please tell me that's not true, but it is. And that was in vitro meat. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, yes, there are now, patents have been taken out on in vitro meat in Holland and the United States, and it is, it's on the horizon. And so we will be eating, we will have the opportunity, if you want to call it that, of eating meat that has been produced in a artificially and without the slaughter of animals. I don't know if you saw it, but the New York Times had a contest a few weeks ago about people could write about why it is moral to eat meat. And Ingrid Newkirk, the founder of People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, wrote that she would now be able to eat meat for the first time in many years because it would be produced in vitro. So at least some people are looking forward to that. I can't say that I'm one of them, however.
I can't say I am either.
Well, the problem with it, the difficulty now is that it's very expensive to produce at this point. They also, the issue is musculature. So because much of the texture, the tastiness, if you will, of meat comes from its muscle, and so these products will not have muscle per se.
Oh, gosh.
So I think it's on the horizon. The question is what kind of welcome it will get from meat eaters, and I don't think it's going to get a whole lot from the meat eaters that I know.
Yeah, I mean, especially since so many of us are moving toward organic and grass-fed, and, you know, I just got back from England, and I saw hundreds of grass-fed cows and pigs
yes.
and chickens
yes. well,
and
that's
sheep.
Certainly
and...
A growing segment of the, of meat production.
Yeah.
Possibility for the problems is insects. About 1,000 species of insects are edible, and many of them are eaten by peoples around the world. So
yeah.
that
yeah.
may be one way that we can continue to have our meat and be a little gentler on the planet as well.
Yeah, I think that's going to take a whole new paradigm shift there. Talk to me very quickly about the Iowa legislature. They recently passed a controversial bill to protect factory farms. You're no longer allowed to go as a journalist, or if you're associated with any kind of press, you're no longer allowed to go undercover or openly to take photographs of these horrific factory farms. What does that mean?
Yes, that's true. Iowa recently passed what the so-called ag gag law. It's not the first state. Several states have passed those similar laws. Kansas is one of them, for example, and others. And so it is a response to the increasing number of exposés produced by undercover investigators for a Humane Society of the United States, for example, or other animal rights, animal welfare organizations that have found animal abuse in production facilities or processing facilities.
Yeah.
And so instead of responding and trying to ensure that animals are treated humanely, state legislatures have gone the other way and tried to essentially prohibit investigative reporters from examining and revealing these kinds of abuses.
Yeah, so wrong on so many levels.
It is.
I want to finish today. The headlines before I left for Europe around March, April time, the headlines on the news were about pink slime. I've been told we actually eat much worse than pink slime. But talk to us a little bit about that, if you would.
Well, pink slime is an example of framing, and so that the label pink slime framed that discussion in ways that the meat industry really couldn't win. And so what has happened is that many buyers of lean, finely textured beef, LFTB, which is what the industry calls pink slime, many of the customers of so-called pink slime have backed away from it. And what that has meant is that the companies that produce that, which it really takes red meat that's produced as part of the slaughter process, and so it takes the scraps of red meat and it separates those from the fat, and then puts them in and uses them in hamburger or other meat products. And so it's been going on for a very long time. It's nothing new. And it is one way to add more lean meat to things like hamburger. Mm. The problem for the industry is that it was framed by a USDA meat inspector who called it pink slime, and that was picked up by the media, and it became a huge public relations nightmare for the industry. And so the company, BPI, Beef Products Incorporated, has closed three of its plants, including one in Garden City, where I've been in that plant in the past, and several hundred people have lost their jobs as a result of that. Mm. But what that means is we probably won't see pink slime in any more products or in very few products.
Well, we hope not. And some statistics here that I read on a deck that you'd put together: food poisoning from contaminated meat results in 76 million illnesses, 325,000 hospitalizations, and 5,200 deaths a year.
Yeah.
So that's we should know where our meat comes from, basically.
Well, we should. We should be intelligent eaters. And, eating is not only a nutritional act, and it's also an agricultural act. It's also a political act and a moral act as well. And so we vote with our stomachs, and we support the food production system that there are different ones. There's the industrial model that relies on CAFOs, confined animal feeding operations, and the kind of production process that we've been talking about today. And then there is the model that Michael Pollan calls the pastoral model, which is small farmers growing food locally, humanely. And we have a choice of which industrial model or the pastoral model, which one we want to support.
We do indeed.
And so we vote with our stomachs.
We do indeed. Professor Donald Stull, thank you so much for being with us. Very interesting stuff, and good to talk with you today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And Professor Stull's book, again written with Michael Broadway, is called Slaughterhouse Blues, The Meat and Poultry Industry in North America. And we're going to go to break in just a moment. But before we do, I just want to say a very quick thank you to Eric Ryder, who filled in for me while I was gone in overseas. For those who know, my mother, or don't know, my mother passed away at the end of April, and so I was back home doing lots of family stuff. And then I came down with bronchitis and laryngitis, and so Eric filled in on one show for me at least. I thank you for doing that.
It was a pleasure. Yeah, I wish I had more time to research the guests, and you know, hopefully I managed to ask some intelligent questions. But
well, I think I gave you a lot of questions. So, and I know you did well. You did, because I listened the following day. I didn't listen that day because I didn't want to put you under pressure.
I appreciate that.
But I know you did really well.
And well, your email said my voice sounds like Minnie Mouse right now. So
Minnie Mouse on steroids.
Minnie Mouse on steroids. I kind of wish that I'd been able to hear that show.
No, every time I spoke, my brother collapsed in fits of laughter. So.
Right.
And when I tried to laugh, that was even more amusing. But it's just one of those times. And, you know, we talk a lot about taking care of ourselves on the show. And I think... when you go through stressful situations and you fly on, you know, jetliners, these things happen.
Absolutely.
So I wanted to let listeners know that for people who like to go outdoors, I found this weekend because I went to Miller Sylvania Park. Have you been down there, Eric? It's Southeast Olympia.
I haven't been there yet.
Well, I decided, when you lose somebody close to you, it kind of makes you look at life and determine to live it more consciously. Even though we think we're living consciously, we can live it even more consciously.
True enough.
And, you know, I grew up in a household that went out a lot. At weekends, we went out to play as a family. And so there are still a few parks around this area. I think I've done most of them, but some of them that I haven't done. And so Miller Sylvania Park down in Southeast Olympia was one I hadn't been to. So I went down there this month, this Saturday, before I went to the Wolf Haven. I went down there first and discovered that June is the great outdoors month in state parks. So I don't know if you visit state parks, but it's normally $10 a day or $30 a year for a Discover Pass.
Mm-hmm.
But throughout June, many of the parks out there in Washington State have free events. So it's worth checking out for somebody who's interested.
Excellent.
Yeah. We need to go out and play more.
We do indeed. And hopefully we'll get some more of that sunny weather that we've had recently so that we could do that.
Well, you know me, I go out in the rain. Doesn't matter. I still go out.
Well, true enough. But it is more enjoyable when it's a little bit sunny.
Oh, definitely. All right, then. So we're going to shift gears a little now. We're going to talk with Dr. Roy Sessions. He's a medical doctor. And he's written a book. He's written a book called The Cancer Experience. But we're not going to be talking so much about cancer. We're going to be talking about the doctor, the patient, and the journey, because that's what his new book is about. It's his philosophies on medical ethics and communication between doctor and patient. And so we're going to get him on the line in just a moment. And we'll be talking with Dr. Sessions when we come back. Please do stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Looking for unconditional love, an exercise buddy, or a great listener? Paws has the dog or cat of your dreams, just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967, because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at paws.org or call 425-787-2500.
If you want to reach a large audience of like-minded people, people with integrity, people who strive to live well and live strong, let Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair shine a spotlight on your message. Tell us about your business, product, service, or event, and we'll help you craft your message and promote your good work. Email Vicki at conversationslive.net or call 425-269-4772. That's 425-269-4772. 4772.
OMG! Grammar abuse is no LOL! Hire a copywriter today and make sure your business communications rise above the crowd and deliver the results you need. Call 800-495-7617 today. BTW, IMHO, copywriters rule. Call 800-495-7617. BFN.
Do you have legal questions? Need to know where to turn?
Hi, this is Rick Gregrick, your host of Northwest Legal Compass.
Northwest Legal Compass will address your questions on a variety of legal topics, including estate planning, asset protection, real estate and business planning, and more. The legal and accounting staff of Gregrick and Associates are dedicated to providing you with superior legal and tax services. Their integrated counsel is geared to the achievement of your goals.
Visit us on the web at rjglegal.com.
Be sure and tune in every Friday at noon here on Alternative Talk 1150.
Next week on Conversations Live, where Vicki St. Clair, world champion adventure racer Robin Benicasa, talks about the power of synergy. Whether you're building a successful lifelong marriage, wanting your kids to clean up their room, working on a short-term project with colleagues, or planning to scale a mountain, Benicasa coaches you over the finish line to success. Join us next week at noon for How Winning Works. See conversationslive.net for podcasts of past shows and what's next.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate, making a difference, one word at a time.
Bringing you fresh perspectives every day. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And my guest in this segment is Dr. Roy B. Sessions. He's retired from active practice in 2008 and is currently professor of otolaryngology, head and neck surgery at the Medical University of South Carolina. During his almost 40-year career, he's been responsible for over 140 scientific publications. He's served 10 years as the chairman of the Department of Otolaryngology, Head and Neck Surgery at Georgetown University School of Medicine. And during his academic career, he served as a consultant to the NCI and was a member of the editorial board of their journal. Dr. Sessions has lectured extensively around the world, and we're pleased to have him here today to talk about his new book, The Cancer Experience, The Doctor, The Patient, The Journey. Dr. Roy Sessions, welcome.
Well, thank you for asking me.
Oh, you're very welcome. I had to look up how to say otolaryngology, so I knew I was going to...
We just want to keep you on your toes with your Greek, your ancient language.
There you
how
go.
How about just head and neck surgery?
Head and neck surgery works for me. So I want to start off with, in the book, you say that as you've grown older, you've come to realize your good fortune in knowing at a young age what your life's work should be. You knew from a very early age that you wanted to be a doctor. Tell us a little bit about that, if you would.
Well, you know, that's just luck, chance, whatever, good fortune. It's just you're blessed with somehow just knowing that you want to do one particular thing. It's sort of ingrained in you, and it's almost a vocational thing. I see my son who is smarter than I am but doesn't have a clue as to what he wants to do. And I contrast myself to that. And I think it's a blessing to know what you want to do, to start early in life with that sort of ambition.
Oh, I would agree with you. I think to have that knowing is a very enviable thing. You say that often when you're asked why you wrote this book, you say it's not entirely clear to you, and I'm paraphrasing here, but you view the book as an opportunity to expand on issues that are important to mitigating change in the values and ethics of medicine. So tell us a little bit about the book, because you wrote it for healthcare professionals, cancer patients, patients' families.
And also, yes, I wrote it for an array of people, actually. I started out to write to just young physicians and young people in training to think about the moral and ethical responsibilities that they were taking on. But as I came to write it, I realized there was a lay audience out there that could benefit substantially from understanding how doctors think and how doctors are, how they mature and or lack of maturation in the medical profession. And I thought by writing to both audiences, I could help bridge what has become a really unpleasant drift apart, but in the level of affection between doctor and patient. The patient-doctor relationship has suffered as a result of our modern lives and so forth. And it's neither the doctor's fault entirely nor the system's fault, but the fact of the matter is it's a critical thing to have a relationship between a patient and a doctor that's built on ethics and honor and trust. And it's in particular, it's an important factor in the cancer genre, because in cancer, patients are extraordinarily vulnerable. They're terrified. They're emotionally distraught. And they're turning themselves over to someone and some people that they don't know well, and they must develop a level of trust and based on integrity and that feeling that your doctor will do only and recommend only what's best for you.
Right.
That's the essence, really, of a peaceful, if you can call it that, a peaceful journey through the cancer experience.
Right, and I think it's important to say that the book isn't about treating cancer, but it is about creating that dialogue. And this is something that, to me, is very near and dear to my heart right now, because we lost our mother at the end of April and are now dealing with some severe hospital issues that have come to light after I went through the medical records.
I'm sorry to hear that.
And a huge part of it, Roy... A huge part of it was communication. I have, on one hand, surgeons telling me one thing. On the other hand, other doctors are saying the complete and utter opposite. So let's talk about how we can try and get that. You know, and I've done dozens of shows on this kind of thing. So I know the things to look for, and yet it still happened in our own situation.
Yeah, it's astonishing, actually. You would think that, but, you know, there's several factors, and I have an extraordinary amount of energy in the book devoted to communication skills and so forth of doctors and lack of communicative skills. This is not meant as a criticism of the profession, but I spend a whole chapter on patient-doctor communication. And first of all, you have to really think communication is a two-way thing. You're in the communications business. You understand that. I mean,
right.
You can pontificate all you want, but if the person you're speaking to doesn't understand what you're saying on a level that they can relate to, then you haven't really communicated. You've just sort of put out a monologue.
Right.
So that's really the basis of things, and so much unhappiness that such a high percentage of patients who are unhappy with, as you are, if I may use that unhappy word with you, it's because of a lack of communication, because probably nothing physically was done wrong, or planning was maybe done entirely correctly, but it's the dialogue and the communication and the level of human interaction that somehow we don't achieve. And that sets the stage for all sorts of negative feelings and angry feelings on the part of people when things don't always go well. And as you know, just like any endeavor in life, things don't always go well. And certainly in cancer, things don't always work out the way we want them to do. But
right.
If you have that formula of that human contact, if the doctor is emotionally involved in the care of the patient, and if the doctor connects on an emotional level, sort of that transcendental level, then it's amazing what storms people can weather when things don't go well or the treatment fails or whatever. I mean, if you've established the fact that you are working beneficently, in other words, with the best interest of the patient at heart. You have thought this out. You are addressing this. You are sensitive to the needs, et cetera. If you've covered those bases and if you've connected with people emotionally, patients understand. They understand that not everything is solvable and not everything goes well.
Yeah.
It's a really basic formula of communication. It's not just limited to medicine, obviously, but medicine, and especially cancer, is so much more passionate and so much more vulnerable, so much more impacted by these emotional things.
Is it? Let me ask you this, because I haven't asked anybody in America this question, but I met with people after my mother passed away and went through her medical file, her hospital file. Is it
what country was she being treated in?
England.
England.
Now, is it permissible for family members in America to say, I want to look at my mother's or my sister's or my husband's medical reports and go through? Because I think if
it
we
is
had...
permissible.
I was going to say, very quickly, I think if we had seen those while she was still alive, maybe we would have had a different outcome. Maybe we would not, but, you know, the question is there.
Well, it's a legitimate question, and the answer to that is tied up in legalese. If your mother is my patient, and if she says to me, I really don't want to share everything with my children or my husband even, or my father, or whatever, then that's her privilege, and I have to respect her privacy. But in a de facto manner, it's usual that families are granted privy to the records. I can't speak for Great Britain, and the English system is different in many ways than ours. And I don't really know, to be honest with you. I've lectured in England and worked in England a little bit, but it's been a number of years, and I don't really know the status of the relationship between doctors and patients now emotionally. I don't know if there's goodwill that still exists. But if, assuming there is still a residual goodwill between the lay people and the medical profession, I think if the legal sidestep can be made, and if the permission's granted, then a family should have total access, of course, to the records.
Right.
I mean, it's certainly in a court of law, for instance, it's certainly discoverable, So if a judge and a jury can look at it, then certainly the family should have access to it.
You talked about creating an emotional connection, and maybe that's part of the problem in Britain, because with many, not all doctors, we've had some wonderful ones, but with some, there's still that, you know, the doctor is up on the pedestal, so there's very little emotional connection. But
that's a matter of vanity and paternalism and things of that sort. That's a person or people that's a thing of the past. And a doctor should be thought of differently. A doctor should be thought of as sort of not an aristocrat in a social sense, but an aristocrat in the sense of a person who's trying to improve the human condition. However, with that status goes a standard of an obligation for the standard to be high and the morality to be impeccable and the integrity to be there. And so a doctor should have a deference to some extent paid to him or her, but by the same token, there should be more demands put on a doctor morally and ethically and in terms of... And there has to be a lack of arrogance. Arrogance is never admirable, no matter how famous you are.
Yeah,
and unfortunately, professorial types and they are. And I have a lot about in my book about this.
You do. You talk extensively about creating that connection, and that's why I think this is an important book for everybody to read if they're in the medical profession or, you know, for consumers, for people like me. You've mentioned that in the book that oncology is not for the emotionally stingy, but you also talked about some of the rewards you've experienced from treating cancer and saying the most gratifying experience for you is when you see patients post-treatment make those important life changes.
Yeah. Well, you know, people, I'm quoting a little, I'm not quoting, but paraphrasing from the book, I make the point that people wonder, oh my goodness, it must be such a depressing life to be a cancer doctor. Well, it's sometimes depressing and it's sometimes sad because there's so much tragedy. But bottom line is, we cure a lot of people. You know, almost 2 million people in the United States now, and the almost 2 million people that come in with cancer each year. We cure about 60 to 64% of those people, 65%.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are a lot of gratifying experiences. And really, cure is great, and that's our goal. But as I've gotten older, and as I guess it's in the nature of the beast, when you get older, you get a little bit more sentimental and thoughtful and reflective. But bottom line is, I look back, and my most cherished moments were not necessarily the cure, although that was critical. It was the sense that I had really, the gratitude that I had acquired from these people and the sense of gratification I got from feeling the human connection. You know, if you're not, and this is a very important subject, and I wrote a whole chapter on this, if you're not willing to jump in emotionally, and that's why I had the chapter entitled "It's Not for the Emotionally Stingy." And what I mean by that is, if you're not willing to jump in and water, then you really shouldn't be a cancer doctor. And that's not to say you can't be a good doctor or something else less demanding emotionally. But patients, particularly needy psychologically, they have needs that are just extraordinary and emotionally. And if you're not willing and able to jump in a little bit and lower your own emotional barriers, you really ought not be treating these people, because they need more than just cancer care. They need emotional juice. They need emotional contact. And that's what the whole basis of the relationship must be. And that's why I stress that doctor-patient relationship. And doctors are humans, obviously, and they have the same fears as anybody who's getting into a relationship. I mean, that's what love relationships flounder on sometimes, because you're afraid to get hurt. I mean, that's a human characteristic.
Right.
Same is true with a doctor-patient relationship. When you lose a cancer patient, if you are one of those people that's let your guard down and let yourself get involved, it hurts a lot more than if you build a wall.
Well, I think your book really is an important... I have to cut you off there. I'm so sorry, because we're right at the end of our segment. But I think your book really goes into some great information about... You talk about traditional, returning to traditional medical values, promoting closer doctor-patient relationships. And I think you've done an excellent job in this book, The Cancer Experience, The Doctor, The Patient, The Journey. And you can find out, listeners can find out more about it at thecancerexperience.com. Thank you so much, Dr. Sessions,
for
being with us today.
Thank
you. And you can find out more, as I said, at thecancerexperience.com. If you've got feedback on today's show, you can find me at 800-495-7617 or info@conversationslive. See you next week. Live well, live strong.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.